Would you say that atheism is growing in America? I think each and every one of us recognize that there are things going on, whether it be court cases that are trying to remove God from certain settings, trying to ban maybe the Ten Commandments, or laws that are being put into place that are immoral or anti-God. But the evidence is clear. And that evidence is simply this. We are growing up in a time in which basically atheism is considered the new end thing. If you think back with me, let's go about 35 to 40 years ago. Members of the church, 35 to 40 members ago, 45 years ago, you remember if you had a gospel meeting, can you remember having to go get chairs? Remember those days? Where not only you got chairs, but it wasn't a question of is somebody going to be baptized, but how many will be baptized. And then you fast forward to today. Friends, I think we can see what is happening even through the pages of this book. And by that I mean, if you turn in your Bible to Acts chapter 2. In Acts chapter 2, you remember Peter got to preach the very first sermon. It was the day of Pentecost. He was preaching to the Jews. And basically his sermon was this. Christ crucified. You just crucified the Son of God. And you remember about 3,000 souls were saved that day, correct? Yeah. 3,000 people baptized. Now, if you have your Bibles, you might flip over to Acts chapter 17, where we find a different point in history. Acts chapter 17, we find Paul coming across a group of all things, philosophers or educators. And you remember, as he's making his way there, he comes across an idol to the unknown gods. Now, here's a question for you. Did he start by preaching Christ crucified to them? Or did he have to actually back up and teach them, look, there is a God, there's one God, there is one living God? Friends, my point is this. I think today we're living in an Acts chapter 17 environment. 30, 40, 50 years ago, we were living in an Acts 2 environment. When you mentioned to your friends and your neighbors, hey, we're having a gospel meeting, they would come. Today you say, hey, we're having a gospel meeting, and you know what? They don't really, not only do they not come, they don't even know if they believe in a God. A fellow by the name of Josh Gunther and I were carrying on a conversation. He is an atheist. I have the opportunity on a lot of occasions to email, to disperse or discuss with atheists, because in my teachings, a lot of times I get to go to universities. Congregations will have me come in. For instance, maybe you guys sponsor me to come here, and I go, and Friday and Saturday night, I teach on the college campus. And then invite them to come to worship on Sunday. This was one of those occasions I'd met Josh. He and I were emailing back and forth. And I asked him, I said, what's your view on life after death? I want you to look carefully at his response. He said, my view on death and the afterlife is pretty nihilistic and generic of the typical atheist. He says, there is no afterlife, and we've got to do what we can now. It'll make dying a lot easier to know that I'll be known long after I die. So for me, it's kind of like making my ego survive my body. The point being, there are a lot of people who are living that way today. They're not thinking that there's an afterlife. So why should I live a life in accordance with God's will when realistically I'd rather just eat, drink, and be merry and hope that my ego survives my body? I want you to imagine for just a moment that I walk in off the street and I want you to prove that center column to me. How do you prove God really exists? Whether it be to an atheist or whether it be to your coworker or your children, your grandchildren. In other words, if I just walked in here and said, I see a sign out front that says Church of Christ, you've got 30 minutes of my time, I want you to prove to me God is real. Could you do it? And folks, understand, I'm not talking just to your preacher or to your elders. I'm talking to each one of you individually. Can you prove God is real? Here's the problem we have in the church today, guys. One of the problems. Our children are learning what we call the scientific method. They start learning the scientific method usually at about age 11 or 12. The scientific method simply says this. In order for something to be real, you have to be able to use one of your five senses. You have to touch it, taste it, hear it, smell it, or feel it. You have to use one of your five senses, go into a laboratory setting, repeat your findings, and then it's real. Where does that put God? Because according to the Bible, God is a spirit. Those who worship Him must worship Him in spirit and in truth. So our children are learning what we call the scientific method. They learn it for 5 or 6 years in junior high and high school. By the time they hit seniors and they're starting to grapple with their own faith, folks, they've learned a scientific method that basically excludes God. There's a page off of a website. I grabbed this just to show you what all's out there. This is from an atheistic website. It says, "No God, no guilt. The belief in God awakens fanaticism and guilt. Live free and responsible. Debaptize yourself." Now, I'm assuming that involves a hairdryer. I don't know. I've never been debaptized. But the point is, they are actively recruiting our children. If I were to ask you this morning, can you prove to me that Abraham Lincoln was real? Now, as I'm looking out at you, I don't see anybody that lived during the time that Abraham Lincoln lived. He was born 200 years ago last year. Or for those of you who have never been overseas, how do you know for sure that there really is a Great Wall of China? And you look at me and you say, "Well, Brad, you know, we've got the writings of Abraham Lincoln. We can get in our car. We can drive to his childhood home in Kentucky. We've got pictures of him. We've got evidence that Abraham Lincoln is real." And as for the Great Wall of China, folks, you put me on a computer that has internet, and within about 3 minutes, we can be looking down from a satellite at the Great Wall of China. We can prove it. But again, folks, let's be honest. God is a spirit. How do we prove to our children that He's real? What I want us to do is I want us to look at this intelligent designer. And I want us to begin by looking at three ways, three arguments of logic that we can use to convince whether it be an atheist, whether it be our child, our grandchild, whether it be a coworker who is struggling, that God is real. And folks, we all have coworkers that are going to be struggling. You think about a time in their life where maybe they're going through a death of a family member, or maybe they get struck with cancer, and they're going to be sitting there at their desk, pounding their fist on the desk, saying, "If there really is a God, how can He allow this to happen to me?" That's when, as a faithful Christian, we need to be ready to step up and teach them the truth. That is a doorway opening for each one of us. How do we do it? Here are three arguments that we're going to look at. I realize some of those words are kind of big. Don't let them throw you. The first one is the cosmological argument. It's actually probably my favorite. The second is the anthropological. All you got to remember on that one is morals. Do morals exist? Yes. Where'd they come from? Number three is this idea of design. Anytime you have design, by definition, you must have a designer. So let's look at each one of these for just a moment. Let's say that my children come up to me and they say, "Dad, you know, every weekend you're preaching about this God, but I've never seen Him. How do you know He's real?" What am I going to do? I'm going to simply use the first argument. We're going to walk outside. I'm going to point up to the night sky. And I'm simply going to say, "Do you see all that stuff? Where did it come from?" Because my children can see the moon. They can see the stars. They recognize Scientifically speaking, there's stuff out there. So the obvious question is, okay, where did the stuff come from? Folks, there's only three options. There's only three options of where the universe itself came from. Option number one is that the universe is eternal. Meaning, it has always been here and it will forever always be here in the shape that it's in today. That's option number one. Option number two, the universe is not eternal, but rather it just sprang into existence from nothing. In other words, one day there was nothing, quite literally nothing, and then one day, poof, there was a universe. Or option number three, it's not eternal. It didn't spring into existence from nothing, but rather it was created. Let's look at each one of those for just a moment. And just to make a point, you can do this argument with just about anything. I was having a discussion with an atheist one time, and he basically said, all right, Brad, take your best shot. Give me your best proof that there's a God. I literally just took off my shoes and said, there's your proof right there. There's a fellow apologist out there that loves using this argument. He looked at me kind of like you guys are looking at me. He said, what are you talking about? I said, my shoe. I said, my shoe fits into one of those three categories. Either my shoe is eternal, which you can look at my shoes and tell that's not the case. They're definitely wearing down. Or maybe my shoe, maybe one day I was walking along in my sock feet, and poof, there was just a shoe. Or maybe my shoe was created by something superior to it. Now, this atheist, he recognized, he realized, okay, obviously your shoe's not eternal. Obviously it didn't create itself from nothing. Your shoe was made by a shoemaker. I said, okay, now let's talk about the shoemaker. Where'd he come from? And then we started following it back. See, you can go several different ways back. I can get my shoe back on. There we go. You can go several different ways back, but the point being the same. Let's look at each one of these for just a moment. Is the universe eternal? Folks, scientifically speaking, we know that's not the case. In fact, those of you who have ever studied astronomy, you probably know why I use the image that's on there. That is a spiral galaxy. What's the point? Folks, spiral galaxies are actually expanding or radiating outwards. That one image just by itself is proof that this universe had a beginning. In fact, the two men who proved that beyond the shadow of a doubt, Albert Einstein and Edward Hubble. Albert Einstein said, his greatest failure was something called the cosmological constant. You see, deep down, he didn't want the universe to have a beginning because he realized the implication. He did theorize. He thought, you know, if it did, here's what we should see. He gets a letter, basically, from Edwin Hubble saying, come to my observatory in California. I want you to look through this telescope. You're going to see something. We call it redshift today. It's exactly what Albert Einstein had thought. You see, the universe is expanding. We know it had a beginning. In fact, evolutionists will even admit it. Robert Jastrow, in commenting on the universe itself, listen to what he said. The lingering decline predicted by astronomers for the end of the world differs from the explosive conditions that they have calculated for its birth. But the impact is the same. Modern science denies an eternal existence to the universe, either in the past or the future. Option number one is unscientific. It's no good. We've got to chuck it out. That only leaves us two options. Now, if you're an atheist, do you like option number three? No, because that involves a creator. So they're stuck with option number two. They are stuck arguing this idea that the universe literally came into existence from nothing. Now, if anybody in this auditorium honestly believes you can get something from nothing, I'd like to sell you some nothing after we're done here. I mean, be honest. Don't you think Walmart would have it on sale for $5.99? We got nothing for $5.99. So instead, they realize that's illogical. They realize it's ridiculous. So what they try to do is they try to shrink it down to a very small point in space. They blow some smoke, and they hope our kids can't see through it. Let me show you what I'm talking about. Alan Guth was given an interview in Omni magazine not too long ago. He was asked this question: how big is this very early pre-inflation universe? In other words, how big was matter before the Big Bang happened? Look at his answer. He said, amazingly small, about 10 to the minus 24 centimeters across. Smaller, he says, than a proton. And also amazing, it would contain only about 25 pounds of matter. What's my next question? Where'd the 25 pounds come from? Folks, he hasn't explained the origin of the universe. All he's done is shrunk it down to 25 pounds, blow some smoke to hope you don't see through it. Furthermore, is it logical, if you look around this room, there are some of us in this room that could lose 25 pounds of matter? Is it logical to believe that everything, not only in Texas, not only in North America, not only on planet Earth, but in all of the universe, that everything came from 25 pounds of matter? Is that logical? Folks, that only leaves you one option. And that option is that the universe was created. It is a self-evident truth that nothing produces nothing. In view of this, since something now exists, it must follow that something has existed forever. That something was responsible for the creation of the universe. That something, folks, is God. So the first way that I prove to my children there's a God, they come to me, they say, Dad, how do you know there's a God? I simply walk outside and say, you see all that? Where did it come from? Somebody says, okay, you know, I understand what you're saying, Brad, but Richard Dawkins asks a question a lot. And his question is, where did God come from? Folks, Richard Dawkins has a problem with the idea of eternality. Let's be honest. Richard Dawkins is a fairly decent pop culture writer, but he's miserable when it comes to actually intellectually thinking about what's going on. He doesn't understand the concept of eternality. I don't have to give him where God came from, because first off, if I did, if I said God came from X, what's the next question? Where'd X come from? It's an argument ad infinitum, meaning it's going to go on forever and ever and ever. He doesn't grasp the concept that God is eternal. And you say, okay, Brad, how do you know that? Here's how I know it. Would everybody in this room agree with me that matter exists today? Yeah. Okay. Would you agree also that something cannot come from nothing? Yeah, that's logical. Folks, if we've got something here today, that means something has been here forever. That means something violates the natural laws of science, because something has eternal properties. That something is God. NASA astronomer John O'Keefe, he put it this way. He said, we are, by astronomical standards, a pampered, cosseted, cherished group of creatures. He said, if the universe had not been made with the most exacting precision, we could have never come into existence. It is my view that these circumstances indicate that the universe was created for man to live in. So, how do I prove there is a God? Number one, the cosmological argument. I simply ask, where did this stuff come from? Number two is the existence of morals. Do we all agree that morals exist? Folks, even evolutionists agree morals exist. I had an atheist one time. He tried to tell me, he said, well, Brad, not everybody believes in morals. I said, oh, really? I said, if you have two atheistic thieves, they go and rob a bank, and one of them turns to the other and says, hey, I'm taking 80% of this. You think the other one's going to say, okay? No, he's going to, I want my half. Even among thieves, there is this idea of right and wrong. If you don't believe me, try this. There's a question that I ask atheists almost every single time when I start communicating with them by email. I ask them, would you mind if I come to your house, rob you blind, and kill your family? You know what every single one of them has told me? They don't want me doing that. They recognize right and wrong. Now, you think with me for just a moment. Morals only arise in man. That means we need to be able to account for where do they come from. I mean, you don't see a lion weeping because he just ate a gazelle. So as you look at that list right there, what do we call those behaviors? That's wrong, correct? Now, in order for something to be wrong, we've got to ask ourselves, what is the standard for that? In other words, what makes it right or what makes it wrong? This time, we only got two options. Option number one, we got all of our ethical code from God, or option number two, we got it from man. Now, if you're an atheist, how many options you got? This time you only have one. All right? Let's think about it for just a moment. If I'm an atheist, I'm forced to say that ethics, which I do believe in, came from man. What's the problem with saying that? Folks, my question would be, all right, who gets to decide what is right and wrong? For instance, Chuck Davis quoted for you guys two quotes earlier this morning. One of them was, give me the textbooks and I will control the state. That's from Adolf Hitler. Did Adolf Hitler think he was doing right? Absolutely he did. He thought he was perfecting the human race. In his eyes, he thought he was doing right. Now, folks, think about it for just a moment. Ultimately, who gets to decide? If we were to turn to the teens and we tell them, you know what, for the next week, you get to decide all the rules in the house. Would there be some differences? Absolutely there would be. So who gets to decide? Basically, an easy way to look at it would be like this. Let's say that, let me see who I can pick on. Let's say Myra and I, we both hear about a job. It's a job that pays $500,000, and all you got to do is test hammocks all day long. 8 hours a day, you just lay in a hammock. Now, Myron's got he's got an interview at 1 o'clock tomorrow. I've got an interview at 1:30. I'm a little bit nervous because I know he's got more experience than I do. So about 12 o'clock, I go and I slit all four of his tires. I get the job. What's the problem? Folks, in my mind, that's a good thing. I got the job, I get the money, survival of the fittest. But I think everybody in here recognizes that is wrong. You see, ironic is it not, we recognize morals exist, but evolutionists and atheists won't tell you where those morals came from. The reason why they won't is because they're forced to say they came from man. And everybody in here recognizes if men were allowed to do this, it would be a nightmare. The only logical conclusion is that we've adopted God's unchanging standard. The Bible talks about the fact that God is eternal, He is holy, He is just, He is forever righteous. In fact, whatever He does, commands, or approves is ultimately for our good. So the second way that I today can prove that there really is a God is just the very existence of morals. All right? Number three, what about design? I'll share this with you real quickly. Anytime, obviously, you have design, you have a designer. I was doing a televised debate in New Zealand 2 years ago. It was a 3-hour debate with an atheist, a surgeon by the name of Dr. Joe. In fact, I'll give you guys the long version. Dr. Joe, in New Zealand, they do speak English, okay? But it's British English. It doesn't have any slang to it. There's no southern twang. I thought, you know what, I'm a Christian. I'm going to go over and show this gentleman that Christians are not evil people. So I went over and I shook his hand. I said, tell me a little bit about yourself, Dr. Joe. I heard him say, my name is Dr. Joe. I'm a surgeon. I practice homeopath. I'm an atheist and a terrorist. I thought, okay, this is going to be a short debate because I'm not sticking around with a terrorist. And so I repeated it back to him just to make sure I'd heard him right. I said, okay, you're a surgeon, you're a homeopath, atheist, and a terrorist. Well, when I said terrorist, all the cameramen, everybody erupted into laughter. One of the cameramen came over and walked over and he whispered in my ear, he said, Taoist, not terrorist. I said, great, so I've already offended this man. Yeah, leave it to the boy from the South. So we, about midway through this debate, I decided to basically set him up. And I started to ask Dr. Joe a series of questions that I knew he could not answer. I said, Dr. Joe, could you tell the viewing audience where the original matter for the universe came from? And he kind of hung his head. He said, no, we don't know that. I said, no problem. I said, Dr. Joe, could you tell us how we went from non-living material, from those rocks, to living material? He kind of slumped his shoulders. He said, well, we don't really know that either. I said, oh, that's okay. So maybe then you could tell the viewers this. How did we get that first self-assembled cell? He kind of hung his head even lower. He said, we don't know that. I said, that's okay, Dr. Joe. How about this? How in the world did we violate a law of science that says everything should go to disorder and actually assemble an organized cell? And I kid you not, by this time, he is looking at the floor, and he looks just absolutely whipped. He said, well, we don't know that. And so then I shifted gears on him, and I said, hey, Dr. Joe, have you ever seen the brachial plexus? It's a nerve plexus. It sits right under your arm. It's one of the biggest plexuses in your body. It looks like a big spider web, and these nerves are huge. In fact, if I were to hold it up to you, you'd easily be able to see it. He perks up. He says, oh, yes, I've seen it. I said, so you've actually seen this complex nerve? Oh, yes. He said, I've even done surgery on it. I said, so you're actually telling me that you've seen the design in this nerve plexus? He said, yes, I've seen the design. And as soon as it left his lips, he realized what he just admitted to. Because, folks, anytime you have a design, by definition, there's got to be a designer. Now, I'll go ahead and give you the ending of that part. He immediately crawfished on me. He said, but your body has vestigial organs in it that are evolutionary byproducts that are proof of evolution. According to evolutionists, vestigial organs are things that you don't need that are leftovers. I smiled at him. I said, you know what, Dr. Joe? I said, you've had medical training. I've had medical training. How about we take these cameras and we go into a sterile operating suite and I'll cut all of your vestigial organs out. He didn't want to do that. I enjoyed that debate, by the way. When we look at design, what do we see out there? Like if I were to ask you, what does it take to get a heavenly body in just the right place in space? I mentioned to you this morning that I'm not a numbers guy and I'm going to stick by that. But I do want to give you some numbers just so you'll appreciate what it would take. What are the statistical odds? Uh-oh, did we lose our connection in the back? What are the statistical odds of getting a heavenly body in just the right place in space? For instance, what would it take to have a heavenly body with the right location in the galaxy, or the right tilt, or the right rotation? Let me give you the numbers so that you can actually appreciate. For instance, the odds of being in the right type of galaxy. Here we are, we're in the Milky Way galaxy, is 1 in 7. The odds of being in the right place within that galaxy, that is, not too far out on one of those spiral arms or not too close to the center, folks, getting to the right place would be 0.05 to the 5th billion. The odds of being near the right sun, now that's the right age sun, That is one that's not flaring up or flaming out. It's 1 in 100. The odds of being the right distance from that sun is 1 in 40. The odds of having the right rotation rate that would allow for springtime and harvest, 1 in 4. The odds of having the right tilt, 1 in 360. Guys, you add all of those up, multiply them together, the number that you see at the bottom of the screen, that is the statistical odds of simply getting a heavenly body in the right place. But let me remind you, we don't have life yet. All we've done is put a heavenly body in space. Statistically speaking, that's off the charts. We still got to add things like water, don't we? Not only do we need to add some water, we got to have enough water for like a water cycle. And what about that sun? You know, according to the textbooks, 93 million miles away, and yet, supposedly, everything just got here from a Big Bang explosion. Now, I want you to think about this. In every church I've ever attended, there's an argument. There's like a fight, internal fight going on. And I suspect it probably happens here. We don't like to talk about it much in the church. And usually, bless their hearts, there's a deacon that is kind of in charge of this argument. And it has to do with a little box on the wall. And that deacon is responsible for the thermostat in this room. And for whatever reason, it seems like women want that box at one temperature and men want it at a different temperature, and that poor deacon's got to decide, am I going with the guys or am I going to sleep on the couch tonight? And yet, folks, God set the temperature for the sun 93 million miles away, perfect to sustain life here on this earth. If you don't think that's impressive, you think about the last week here in Texas, how cold it's been. Understand, we're just talking about a few degrees in the grand scheme of things. You imagine if that sun was just 100 miles further away, you think about what last week would have been like. Sun is like a giant nuclear engine. It gives off more energy in a single second than mankind has produced since creation. Converts 8 million tons of matter into energy every single second. Has an interior temperature of more than 20 million degrees. I copied this off of Science Digest 1981, and I use it just as an example of design. I hope that it impresses you the way it impressed me. Listen very carefully to what they discovered about the Earth. They said the Earth moves in its orbit around the sun, departing from a straight line by 1/9 of an inch every 18 miles. If we departed by 1/8 of an inch, we'd come so close to the sun that we would be incinerated. If we departed by 1/10 of an inch, we'd find ourselves so far from the sun that we would freeze to death. Imagine calling up the Texas Department of Transportation saying, hey, we need you to pave a road 18 miles. By the way, you can only depart from a straight line by 1/9 of an inch. I hope nobody in here works for the Texas Department of Transportation. I've already learned somebody's name in here was Haven, so I got in trouble with the Haven or Heaven thing. What about the moon? Again, our students are told that the moon is just there by accident, that it's a result of this Big Bang explosion. What does the moon control? It controls the tides, doesn't it? Now, folks, think about this for just a moment. If we were to move the moon just a little bit closer to us, what would happen? You know those tsunami waves that we saw about a year or two ago? They would be everyday occurrences on coastal cities. Now, here in Dallas, that wouldn't be that big a deal. If you're living in somewhere like Corpus Christi, that would be a huge deal. What happens if we move the moon just a little bit further away? All of a sudden, those tides, they would stop. They wouldn't have the gravitational pull of the moon. And you say, yes, so what? And the oceans would eventually stagnate. And again, you say, so what? Folks, the so what is this. We get more than 80% of the oxygen we breathe from the ocean. Microscopic plants in the ocean that are dependent on those tides. You move the moon just a little bit further away and suddenly we don't have enough oxygen to breathe. What about the atmosphere? Now understand, all I'm doing is I'm trying to systematically lay out what it would take in order to get a heavenly body in space just to sustain life. In other words, I'm trying to remind you of what God did for us. Are we really to believe that the Earth's atmosphere, the tilt, the rotation, the distance of the moon, the distance from the sun, the Earth's orbit, the placement in the galaxy, that all of that is simply a product of evolution? Michael Murray once made the comment, he said, almost everything about the basic structure of the universe. For example, the fundamental laws of physics, the initial distribution of matter and energy, he said, is balanced on a razor's edge for life to occur. Do we see design? Catholic priest by the name of George Cone, he attended the 2006 American Association for the Advancement of Science meeting. It was a meeting in which they were trying their very best to dismiss the idea of intelligent design. They reached out to religious leaders and they said, hey, we want people who would be willing to basically ridicule this to come to this meeting and speak out. Well, George Cone came. I want you to listen carefully to what he said. He said, the intelligent design movement belittles God. It makes God a designer, an engineer. The God of religious faith is a God of love. He did not design me. If I were to ask you, does the human body show design? In my training, I probably dissected well over 500 or 600 human bodies. Folks, you cannot look inside of the human body without seeing massive design. And I mean massive design. You know, if I were to ask you, which one came first? In your body, if we were to apply into this evolutionary step-by-step millions of years paradigm, did we evolve nerves or organs first? Now, your gut instinct is always to say, well, we've got to have organs. How good would those organs be if you didn't have nerves to innervate, for instance, your stomach right now to digest the food you just ate? You see, your heart is beating because of a nerve. The vagus nerve is going to your heart without any input from you. You say, ooh, okay, well, obviously you've got to have nerves. Folks, what good would the nerves be if you didn't have organs to innervate? It's not like you just had nerves dangling around waiting to evolve something. Furthermore, you think about this. Nerve cells by themselves are of very, very little use unless you have a brain or a spinal cord to process the information. It's kind of like if you had a mouse for your computer, but no computer. Furthermore, we know that it takes a nerve cell to make a nerve cell. So where'd that first nerve cell come from? In other words, how do you go from a living brain that is dependent on nutrients, it is dependent on oxygen, how do you go from that, from a cosmic explosion? Fact is, you can't. You see, I don't have enough faith to be an atheist. A fellow by the name of Michael Behe wrote a book called Darwin's Black Box, in which Michael Behe talked to him several times. He is a biochemist, and he basically says this, look guys, there are things in the body that are far too complex to have just gotten here by chance. And he breaks it down to a microscopic level, and he shows the proteins and he says, you can't get there from here. Paul Davies and Adams Phillips, they give this quote, I love this quote. It says, some scientists say just throw energy at it and it'll happen spontaneously. That's a little bit like saying put a stick of dynamite under a pile of bricks and bang, you've got a house. Of course, you won't have a house, you'll just have a mess. And folks, that's basically what we're looking at today. How about this one? How many of you today, as we're going through the line to eat, you go over and you get your drink, and instead of either having tea or water, how many of you would like to drink hydrochloric acid? There's not a soul in here that wants to drink hydrochloric acid. Because after all, depending on the strength of it, it could literally eat your esophagus. And yet right now, in your stomach, every single one of us in this room, we have hydrochloric acid that is breaking down the foods that we ate for lunch. Which begs the question. Which one came first? Hydrochloric acid producing cells or a container to store it in? Which one did you evolve? And you say, well, obviously I had to have the stomach that sheds its lining every 3 to 5 days. I had to have a container. Folks, why would your body go to all the trouble of evolving a container if the acid wasn't there yet? It's not like your stomach said, well, I know the acid's coming one day. You realize you need all four of the systems behind me. You need bile from the gallbladder. You need pancreatic enzymes. You need stomach acid, intestinal enzymes. All of that has to be present just to break down foods, just to keep your body alive. There is no step-by-step process that will allow for that. What about the respiratory system? If I asked you, which one did you evolve first, your heart or your lungs? Now, again, our gut response is, got to have a heart. But folks, ask somebody in this room that's had a heart attack. What good is your heart if you can't get oxygenated blood to it? That muscle tissue, it dies. And you stop and say, oh yeah, I forgot about that. We got coronary arteries that are feeding the heart muscle itself, oxygenated blood. Okay, yeah, we got to have lungs. Folks, what good are the lungs if you don't have a pump to get the blood to and from the lungs? I mean, have you stopped to think about the fact that what we are doing is we are taking a gas and we're putting it into a liquid? Allegedly, we evolved from fish. Fish take a gas from a liquid, convert it, and put it into another liquid. And yet, supposedly, we evolved from them. Folks, have you ever thought about the fact that they say whales used to be mammals. They used to be cows. And they evolved back in... Now think about this for just a moment. You've got a fish that decides, you know what? I'm tired of swimming. I'm going to go and I'm going to crawl out onto the beach. Okay. Not only does he have to crawl out on the beach and shed his scales and get lacrimal glands to be able to moisten his eyes and change his respiratory system, he has to convince his girlfriend to go with him. And they've got to evolve all of this stuff within about 3 minutes because the seagulls that are flying above them are looking at free lunch. So let's say they make it. They're out here for several hundred million years. They've now gone from fish to some cow-like creature. They look and they just have longing gaze at the ocean. And they think, you know, I'd really like to return. So they evolve a blowhole in the back of their neck. They shed the fur, they get blubber so that they can be pressurized to deep depths, and they go back in the water. That's what our kids are learning, folks. I don't have enough faith to be an atheist. That's garbage. Psalm chapter 94, verse 9, he who planted the ear, shall he not hear? He who formed the eye, shall he not see? Proverbs 20, verse 12, the hearing ear, the seeing eye, the Lord has made them both. I got about 3 minutes left before we take a break. And I want to give you in those 3 minutes what I call easy proofs that there really is a God. These are 6 or 7 things that you can write down, basically one-liners that you can use to help teach somebody that there really is a God. Proof number one. Every creation must have a creator. Hebrews chapter 3, verse 4, for every house is built by someone. He who built all things is God. Matter exists today. Where did it come from? Proof number two, every design must have a designer. We've already discussed this just a little bit. Folks, do we see design in the earth or do we see design in the human body? Absolutely. Proof number three, codes require somebody to program the code. Now think about this for just a moment. Inside every cell of your body, you have a code, a genetic code, that took us 13 years, hundreds of millions of dollars, hundreds of labs to unravel your DNA. The Human Genome Project. And yet, here's the funny part. Right now, we're spending millions of dollars in what's called the SETI program. Carl Sagan once said, he said, if we see a code out in space, that demands there's intelligent life out there. So we've got these micro arrays that are looking for this code out in space, yet you've got a code inside every cell of your body, and they're saying that that just happened to get there. Proof number four, for every material effect, there must be an adequate cause that existed prior to it. This is known as the law of cause and effect. Simply put, if I were to tell you, hey, that little frog, that caused a tsunami wave, you'd say, no, Brad, that wasn't a big enough cause to make that effect. All right? What caused the universe? Proof number five, laws require a lawgiver. James chapter 4, verse 12, there's one lawgiver who is able to save and to destroy. Do we recognize laws today? For instance, is there a law, for instance, of gravity? Or what about the laws of momentum? Folks, we recognize these laws. Have you ever stopped to ask yourself, where did they come from? Laws don't just evolve. Proof number five, we've already discussed a little bit. We've got a moral code. Where did it come from? We know that certain behaviors are wrong. The only option that makes logical sense is that we got it from God. And finally, proof number seven, communication requires a communicator. Do you not think that it's very interesting? Man is the only creature on this planet that can build on knowledge. You thought about that? Can anybody in here think about Henry Ford picturing a CD player, a DVD player, and airbags in one of those Model Ts? I bought several years back a Volvo sedan. I travel a lot. I told the guy, I said, I want one of the safest cars. He told me, he said, this car right here is the safest sedan on the road. And he began to share with me all the airbags it had with it. It had what they basically at that time called an encapsulated air system where you got them on the sides, the top, the behind, the front. I told my wife, I'm like, I want to roll the car just to see this. But the point is this. Henry Ford could not have envisioned that. We can build on knowledge. Animals can't do it. Do you not think a bird, if he could build on knowledge, one year he builds a nest. He teaches his offspring how to do that. Offspring say, well, that's nice and all, but you know what? When it rains, we get wet. We want something over the top of us. So the next year, they build a little roof. And the next year, they build walls on it. And the next year, they decide, it's warm outside. I want central heat and air. I sat and I listened to a professor try to brainwash me and tell me that we had spent years evolving out of the trees to walk uprightly because our food source was running out. And we needed to have biped location or locomotion to go get food across the prairie. Folks, it takes a lot more muscles to do that than it does to evolve a voice box. Don't you think animals would have evolved this before this? We're going to take roughly a 10-minute break. And when we come back, we're going to look at those dinosaurs. How do they fit into the grand picture? Did they evolve millions and millions of years ago, or did they coexist with man? I'll go ahead and tell you, for those of you who like pictures, this will be your favorite lesson. We're going to look at lots of good evidence. I hope and I pray that if you're 9 or 99, that you'll stay, that you'll look at the evidence, and that you'll take some notes, because, folks, let me tell you, dinosaurs are the sugar stick candy that evolutionists are offering our kids. And many of them are already hooked by age 5.